Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Mari Yoshihara, author of Musicians from a Different Shore. The book examines why musicians of Asian descent have come to enjoy unprecedented prominence in classical music. Susan Lewis takes us to Pennsylvania Ballet's season opener, with works featuring music ranging from Bach to Shostakovich to the Andrews Sisters. David Patrick Stearns has a profile of tenor Matthew Polanzani, currently appearing in the Opera Company of Philadelphia's production of Rigoletto. And Jason Pfeiffer previews Independence Starts Here, a festival of disability arts and culture. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Musicians from and of Asian descent are ubiquitous in the world of Western classical music, a significant presence in music schools, professional ensembles, and as concert soloists. How Eastern culture came to embrace Western music is the subject of a new book, Musicians from a Different Shore. Its author, Mari Yoshihara, is now an associate professor of American Studies at the University of Hawaii, but began studying piano in her native Japan at the age of 3, a practice common among middle-class households in the last part of the 20th century. In her book, Yoshihara combines historical research with personal interviews of contemporary Asian and Asian American musicians to present both a comprehensive study of the intersection of culture, race, and music, and an intimate glimpse at the human stories behind the trends. I spoke with Mari Yoshihara earlier this week. It's obvious to anybody who goes to classical music concerts or who buys classical music recordings these days that there is a huge amount of Asian and Asian American musicians. Tell us the history of how we've got to this situation.
Well, this is, depending on how you see it, you can see it as a recent phenomenon or a more historical phenomenon. I would say that the noticeable increase in the number of Asians and Asian Americans in classical music, maybe about the last 2 or 3 decades. But there is a long history that led up to it, from the introduction of Western music to Japan, China, and Korea from the late 19th and early 20th century. And, you know, those three nations made very programmatic efforts to make it a very central part of their culture, very much led by the government and then also pushed by the middle class, aspiration for middle class. So there's a long history leading up to it. And especially after the end of World War II in Japan and after Korean War in Korea, after the Cultural Revolution in China, it became a very widely middle class phenomenon for the people there to pursue classical music. So that's sort of the historical and social basis for this recent phenomenon.
And this was about looking west and saying what? What were people saying about the West that convinced them that classical music was something their children should learn?
I would say initially, in the early part of the 20th century, it was classical music was associated definitely with Western modernity. And so the aspiration to become bourgeois middle class was kind of the central economic and social pull for agents. But one of the things that I'm trying to say in the book is that it became a lot more than that, especially in the last 2 or 3 decades. I would say that for most Asians in Asia today, classical music is not necessarily seen as something specifically European or even Western. It's a very central part of their own culture. And so they don't necessarily, especially the musicians who are pursuing it, they don't necessarily think of it as something, they're doing something foreign or Western. It's just, you know, part of their lives and their identity.
You're not writing from a totally uninvolved point of view. Mm-hmm. You yourself went through this phenomenon having your parents encourage you to take a
more
musical
than
instrument.
Okay.
I was putting it as nicely as possible. What word should I use?
Push.
Okay. Your parents pushing you to take up a musical instrument.
Yeah.
The parental influence shouldn't be understated in this because amongst Asians, and I don't want to make a broad sweeping statement, but there would appear to be a greater respect and a greater desire to please one's parents in the mm-hmm. East than there is in the West. Is mm-hmm. that the case?
I mean, it's certainly a generalization, but I think, you know, there's some truth to, you know, those kinds of generalizations. And I mean, because for people who become professional musicians, they really have to start serious training by age 5 or 7 at the latest. And, you know, most kids don't choose to, you know, do rigorous study of classical music at such an early age. I mean, most people start, you know, because they're their parents want them to. And then, especially in Asia, there's stronger emphasis on kind of regimented training, both in practice and lessons. And so that's very central to the way in which these musicians are trained and disciplined, really.
They say the last century was America's century, and this will be China's or Asia's century. Can you foresee a situation when the US and Europe will not be the meccas to which these musicians are drawn, and that you will have orchestras of significant standing in, for instance, China? You already have in Japan, but more so in China.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think so. I mean, and it's interesting. I mean, the introduction of Western music to Asia is not simply kind of a one-way street from West or, say, Europe to Asia. Like, for instance, a lot of Chinese and Korean musicians in the early 20th century, they went to Japan to study, not Europe or the United States, because it was more feasible economically, geographically, and whatnot. And so even today, like in a lot of Japanese orchestras, there are, you know, musicians from other parts of Asia, you know, working there. And so, you know, I can totally see, like, 10, 20 years from now, like, you know, Shanghai Symphony or, you know, Beijing Orchestra, they would be like real players in the world of classical music worldwide.
Maria Shahari. She'll be signing copies of Musicians from a Different Shore at 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon at the Barnes & Noble Bookstore at 1805 Walnut Street, Philadelphia. Musicians from a Different Shore is out now on the Temple University Press imprint.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Today, ballet is danced to music from the pop charts as well as from the concert hall. Pennsylvania Ballet's season opener taps musical possibilities from Bach to Shostakovich to the Andrew Sisters, and the program also explores a range of choreographic styles, from the work of a late great 20th century master to that of an acclaimed rising star of today. WRTI's Susan Lewis has more.
He was a famous trumpet man from our Chicago way.
By the time the Andrew Sisters made their USO tour to entertain the troops in World War II, Patty, Maxine, and Laverne had likely seen a lot of people dancing to their music. Jitterbug, after all, was all the rage. But ballet? It wasn't until 1991 that Paul Taylor put together the tight-knit harmony of the Andrew Sisters with dance, set it in World War II, and crafted a work called Company B.
Now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's a boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B.
Pennsylvania Ballet artistic director Roy Kaiser, who chose Company B to headline this season's opener, is intrigued by the way modern choreographers like Taylor approach work for traditional ballet dancers.
When he plays reveille, he's a boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B.
He's created a wonderful piece that in some ways really utilizes the dancers' classical training, but they are forced to also incorporate a lot of weight. Modern dancers use gravity, they use the floor. And ballet dancers, we spend all of our energy developing that strong back and that very postured look.
Developing that back has been a strength of Pennsylvania Ballet. But Kaiser says he can throw a lot of different styles all at once at this company of dancers, as he did when he put together this program. The evening begins with George Balanchine's Concerto Barocco, a work in which dancers representing instruments bring to life the music of Johann Sebastian Bach. It is reminiscent of another beginning. This was the first ballet Balanchine gave the company to perform when Pennsylvania Ballet was founded.
This company is very rich in Balanchine.
Sandra Jennings, who danced with both the New York City Ballet under Balanchine and Pennsylvania Ballet, says Balanchine fashioned a modern take on his classical Russian training.
He made the positions bigger. He had us dance faster and slower. And it wasn't just the position, but how we got into it. And so it wasn't like trick and run over here and a trick. It made this movement that was so beautifully connected.
In this production, Jennings is a visiting teacher or repetiteur, representing the Balanchine Foundation to teach the choreography the way Balanchine intended. This wasn't a job she originally prepared for.
He told me once, he said, "You know, dear, someday you'll be teacher for me." And I was so hurt because I thought, oh, he doesn't want me to dance. He wants me to be a teacher. But it wasn't that. He was seeing that I understood him and that I could pass on what he taught me. Now I think it's such a gift that I can do this. I'm so excited when I sit in an audience and I see his ballets come to life with new dancers.
Getting to the source is easy when the creator himself is in your midst. As a beginning choreographer, Matthew Neenan would plan his steps in advance. Now, unless it's a large group number, what he does before the first rehearsal is immerse himself in the music, making selections and conjuring an ambiance.
Now I just love to just come up with movement right on the spot. I think I work much better when it's right there and then in the present. Sometimes you can work out stuff on your own body, but stuff you do on your own body isn't going to look the same on someone else.
His work, as it's going, began with the music of Dmitri Shostakovich and took root when he began reading the poetry of Anna Akhmatova, a poet with similar background to the Russian composer.
I had an affinity towards this one poem. And it's kind of sad, but it also has a sense of hope, and it's also about change.
Neenan pored over the many possible combinations of individual Shostakovich works.
I wanted a certain edge to it all. I mean, his music's very edgy anyway. Most of it's in a minor key. I didn't want just the strings. I knew the piano doesn't come in until like halfway into the piece, and I wanted that to be a shock.
Moments of surprise are also part of Company B, set during World War II and reflecting the complexity of emotion during a time of war. Roy Kaiser says the work is both upbeat and somber.
There certainly are undertones of commentary that Mr. Taylor is making on the ugliness and the negative perceptions of war, or the negative realities of war. That being said, there are also light moments in the ballet and a little wit and comedy as well. Different people take very different things away from it.
In some ways, the works on Pennsylvania Ballet's opening program are all different in choreography, in music, and in the mood created on stage. But what runs through every work is an emotional core that reaches out to grab us in its own way. From the classicism of Balanchine and Bach, to Neenan's fluid exploration of human relationships, to Paul Taylor's understated commentary on the darkness that can lie beneath the sun.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The last three performances of Pennsylvania Ballet's season opening program, featuring Concerto Barocco, As It's Going, and Company B, are today at 2 and 8, and tomorrow afternoon again at 2. No matter how great the opera, it's not going to be sung if there are not the right people to sing it. The brawny-voiced tenors who can manage the great works of Verdi don't come around too often, and when they do, you have to worry if they'll sing themselves out. Now Philadelphia Inquirer classical music journalist David Patrick Stearns profiles a singer who comes to Verdi with a lighter touch.
That's Giuseppe Di Stefano, a tenor that old-school opera lovers are dying to clone. The voice is brilliant and virile and goes for broke. Instead, they're hearing something rather different in the Opera Company of Philadelphia's current production of Rigoletto, one that takes your ears down an alternate route that's equally valid. This is Matthew Polanzani, a 39-year-old American tenor who comes to Verdi from Mozart. You're not likely to hear any better in these lyrical Verdi roles, at least these days. The vocal survivors in the 21st century, at least among tenors, are often those who don't pretend their voices are more heroic than they are. They don't rush around to every glamorous theater possible, don't stomp off stage shaking their fists at booers at La Scala, but stop and, well, think about what they're up to.
have a little place that's out in front of my face, which is where I feel my voice. This spot is the place where my voice is, hopefully, all the time. This is what I'm aiming for. So, as long as it's here, then I know that for sure the voice is going to run in the house, and it's going to be bright. If I'm in that spot, then I can afford to sing as softly as I like and have the tone of my voice still speak.
This more exterior-oriented approach towards singing, even if it's a bit of a mind game, has to be easier for a singer to live with than the more common obsession over the minute needs of those tiny little vocal cords deep in the throat. Polanzani goes yet another step further. An essential part of singing for him isn't about making any sound at all, but listening. The idea is that his character is magnetic only if what he's sending out is a creative reaction to what he's taking in. He's married to mezzo-soprano Rosa Maria Passarelli, and though there's probably not a husband in the world who hasn't been told he needs to be a better listener, Polanzani has a professional stake in the matter.
If I'm actively paying attention to what's being said, digesting information, and figuring out what it means to hear the words that I'm saying and how they change me as a person, this is what makes theater. You're not just engaged when you're singing, but the real actor or actress is completely engaged when they're not singing too. And I got to credit my wife a little bit with teaching me about listening, because it was one of the things that she always did best. She was good at listening to what other people were saying to her, and good at making reaction, and good at letting the audience be aware that she heard what they were saying and expressing what it meant. La bella mano candida, scherzate voi, signori. No, no, abbracciami. D'amore ardente. Signore indifferente, vi piace consolare. No, no, ti posso usare. E voglio la parola. Amabile figliuola.
E non ti basta ancor.
E mi potrò
te far. Amabile figliuola.
E mi potrò te
far. Amabile figliuola. Amabile figliuola.
Where do the Verdi singers come from? The popular imagination suggests that they're discovered in warm weather places and in salt-of-the-earth occupations, a gondola singer in Venice, or in a zarzuela troupe in Mexico. Matthew Polanzani comes from Evanston, Illinois, and if he was discovered, in the less dramatic sense of the word, it was in the Music Education Department of Eastern Illinois University, where he first heard a recording of a tenor voice, Jose Carreras, that inspired him to sing. Once he was in the profession, the opera world didn't experience a big Matthew Polanzani moment. After private voice training, he was a young artist at Lyric Opera of Chicago and, starting in 1997, sang small roles at the Metropolitan Opera and worked his way up to leading Mozart parts. And now, Verdi. Those characters are creatures of emotional extremes. They sing nice tunes while destroying the lives of people around them. And they do it loud. Matthew Polanzani is now in his first staged outing with Rigoletto. The fact that a smallish voice is even possible in Verdi is evidence of this post-Jurassic period of opera. Art songs, early music, crossover pops are all part of an opera career today. And if the voices don't seem to grow as large as they once did, at least the characters behind them are more believable, more people-sized. The more pure, lyrical voices like Matthew Polanzani's have always been around. Witness this 1928 recording by the fondly remembered Tito Skipa. But the bigger issue these days is vocal vulnerability. The care and preservation of the fragile tenor voice isn't widely understood. After years of rough singing, American tenor Jerry Hadley recently committed suicide. Italian tenor Salvatore Licitra, who was the next big thing 5 years ago, is now sounding disturbingly labored. Mexican tenor Rolando Villazón, who was on the verge of superstardom, has just announced months of only vaguely explained cancellations. You find yourself wanting to protect the current talent from any outside trauma that could affect that Stradivarius inside their throats. Polanzani, however, has already survived his share. His daughter Alessandra died suddenly at age 16 months from a rare disease. That was Christmas Eve 2005. 7 weeks later, he was singing in Seattle.
And it was good for us to be away from home for a little while. And it was good to be in an environment that wasn't full of memories of her. I have very, very vague recollections of all that time spent in Seattle. Really, the whole year is pretty much a fog.
That there mingled with her feeling some sad thought she was concealing, it implied not that she had ceased to love me, none on earth she said above me, but she sighed.
Home is more important than ever to Polanzani. He and his wife now have a son, Gianluca. He has vowed never to be away from them for more than 6 weeks, and he's kept to that. And Philadelphia audiences stand to benefit. They're only a 2-hour drive from his home in Pelham, New York. The best singers, Polanzani among them, are ones who respect their own individuality, respect their own limits, and become all they can be, with an expression that's very personal to them, and, in turn, very personal to us.
Philadelphia Inquirer classical music journalist David Patrick Stearns. Matthew Polanzani sings the role of the Duke in the final performances of the Opera Company of Philadelphia's production of Verdi's Rigoletto, tomorrow afternoon at 2:30 and on Wednesday at 7:30. Both performances are at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia. You can also hear Polanzani in a Philadelphia Chamber Music Society recital at the Kimmel Center's Perelman Theatre on November 29th. This Thursday, the first Independence Starts Here, a festival of disability arts and culture, begins in Philadelphia. With more than 40 arts organizations across the city taking part, the month-long series is designed to showcase art that's created or inspired by those with disabilities. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, organizers and participants hope the inaugural festival will demonstrate that disability need have no effect on one's ability to create art.
The festival was the brainchild of Mimi Kenny Smith. She's the co-founder of the Amaryllis Theater Company and executive artistic director of VSA Arts of Pennsylvania, a nonprofit that works to create opportunities for those with disabilities to learn through, participate in, and enjoy the arts. About 4 years ago, Smith started an arts access initiative called Independence Starts Here,
which really was to bring people with disabilities and people from the cultural community together in the same room to get to know each other, to develop relationships, and get to understand each other's situation.
For instance, many arts organizations find it intimidating to make themselves more accessible for disabled people, fearing it's too expensive or feeling ignorant of how to be more accommodating. Both audiences and artists with disabilities, in turn, commonly feel excluded from artistic venues and programming. The success of these discussions led Smith to conceive the idea of a festival. The 4-week event is set to include theater, a film screening, art exhibits, book and poetry readings, dance performances, workshops, and concerts. Michael Norris, executive director of ArtReach, a Philadelphia-based group that helps underserved audiences experience arts and cultural programming, is co-chair of the festival planning committee. Norris says one goal of the event is to show that art created by people with disabilities is on the level of art that's created by anyone else.
There's often a perception that the work itself is kind of second tier or whatever, and that was definitely one of the goals that we wanted to rise above and really educate and increase people's understanding that there are a lot of great artists out there. Some of them happen to have disabilities, and we're going to showcase them during the festival.
Defining what it means to have a disability isn't always easy. It can apply to someone who's blind, hearing impaired, mentally impaired, or perhaps in a wheelchair. But Catherine Pennepecker, a textile and visual artist and curator of one of the festival's art exhibits, says there's no clear-cut definition.
You know, there's many faces to disability, you know, and I really believe that everyone has some issue they're dealing with, whether it be a physical disability or an emotional disability or mental or what have you.
Rather than focus on disability, whatever it may be, Pennepecker prefers to be thought of as an artist, judged on the merit of her work.
I have a disability. I have MS, you know, and it affects me. It's not the thing that I put to the forefront, though. And so I see myself as an artist who is just a person doing their thing.
That's not to say that Pennepecker's weavings and the art of others is not informed and influenced by disability. Festival participant Patricia Goodrich is a sculptor and writer who had her leg amputated decades ago as the result of a motorcycle accident.
How I can feel complete and yet a part of this body.
She doesn't avoid this subject matter in her poetry.
Wondering how much you can cut off and still be whole.
Goodrich says that early in her artistic career, she tried to keep her disability separate from her work, but she eventually came to see it as a gift to her art, experiences that provide an altered perspective and an awareness of details that others often miss. And she notices that coming to terms with her disability as an artist has brought greater depth to her work.
When I first lost my leg and they couldn't do anything with prosthetic work, I was much more noticeable. I mean, adults would look away and children would say, "What happened?" You know, or "Look at that lady." And I much preferred the child reaction. There was a kind of core and honesty to it that I would like to be able to bring to my work and that childishness even now.
Philadelphia's Festival of Disability Arts and Culture is meant to be much more than a showcase of art. It's also designed to be an event that's accessible for audiences with and without disabilities. So a simple thing like hanging a painting at the eye level of someone who might be in a wheelchair is given special attention. Festival coordinator Mimi Kenny-Smith says her overarching hope is that anyone with a disability can experience the arts in a way that's best for them.
I mean, I know that sounds Pollyanna, but if they want to just play with the arts and dabble in it and not produce anything in particular, that's great. If they want to pursue a career in the arts, that's also great. If they want to be a patron of the arts, if they want to go to see things, they should be able to.
Though no immediate plans are underway for a subsequent Festival of Disability Arts and Culture in Philadelphia, Smith says there is a real possibility of holding similar celebrations in other parts of Pennsylvania in a few years, as misconceptions about and barriers to disabled people accessing arts remain in society at large. Festival organizers hope to continue demonstrating that creativity is at its best when all are included.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Independence Starts Here, a festival of disability arts and culture, begins on Thursday with an opening ceremony at the Kimmel Center's Parliament Theatre. The festival runs through November 21st. And that's our program. Our thanks this week to Alana Emmett, Tracy Gallagher, Brooke Honeyford, and Gary Kramer. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.